Over the next few months, the JFY Network's podcast will focus on history, examining how events of the past shape and reverberate in our world today. To begin this series, today's podcast welcomes back Quincy College English professor and playwright Stephen Dooner as he reflects on writing and forming the message of history using literature. We'll hear his thoughts on how history is written.
People say that history is written by the winners, but it's not really. History is constantly rewritten by whoever's reading history.
Why some folks only hear the version of news and history they want to hear.
We make fake news today. You know, the idea that, you know, that people might want a better story than what actually happened. The way our imaginations try to cover up and gloss over the truth.
And how science has an impact on the lens we use to view historic events.
About how we think science can know something perfectly. And then what science will actually tell us is what we don't know and not what we know. And maybe if the science isn't perfect and all the variables removed, you can wind up making up a story that never happened. And that is a lesson.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by maintaining grade-level skills and combating learning loss. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Professor Dooner not only teaches literature in his classes at Quincy College, he also writes, directs, and performs in works of theatrical literature. During a recent conversation, I had a chance to chat with him about his direction of and performance in the play, The Audience, by Peter Morgan, which was the inspiration for the Netflix hit series, The Crown. He is also the co-author of Lizzie of Fall River, a play that explores the brutal 1892 murders of Andrew and Abby Borden in Fall River. In order to bring these historic events on stage, an immense amount of research needed to be completed.
So it started, fortunately, I had a co-writer, and his name was Mark Sungini. And he had just published New England's Most Sensational Murders. So he had done a lot of legwork on the conspiracy theories and the theories, and he had come to a final conclusion about who he thought had done it. And I looked at his book, and I'd known Mark for years, and I thought, wow, this is great. So I helped him actually, I proofread that book. So I had it right in the back of my mind when the company said, we want you to direct a play on Lizzie Borden. I said, all right. And they handed me a couple of those old scripts of Lizzie's story. And I looked through some of them and I said, you know, this is a really, you know, great story, but I don't think these plays have it. And could I take a crack at writing it? And this is totally crazy. I never expected them to say yes. And I fully expected to wind up directing one of the old, you know, fashion plays. And they said, sure, without hesitation. They actually said, sure. So now I had a play on commission, which was a really interesting thing. You know, Samuel Johnson says, never write anything except for money. Well, to have a play on commission, it behooved me to actually research and read this stuff. So I reread Mark's chapter, and then I found this compendium of Lizzie Borden conspiracy theories that got a little too far out. And I looked at that, and I decided that I would write, a dreaded meta play that dealt with all of the different theories in a postmodern way. So I needed some structure, something that could hang all of these pieces together, some way in which the main characters at the time were ruminating about who might have done it. And so I went through everything I could find. And then finally, searching on the Fall River website, I found in the Historical Society the Lizzie Borden inquest, when she was brought in for initial questioning with Judge Josiah Blaisdell and Prosecutor Knowlton. She was not afforded a lawyer because this was back before people had to have their defense attorney present. And she was likely drugged, a little bit spacey, from sedatives given to her because her parents had just been hacked to death. And she was sleeping at the women's jail or the jail where with women matrons, the women's quarters. And she was brought in for this questioning. And I saw the structure I needed. It was the actual words. This gave so much legitimacy and so much authenticity to the play. I would start with the Lizzie Borden inquest. The two men would bring her in. And I set up a lot about the history and the culture of the Borden family in Fall River first. And I had them talking about, do you know who this woman is? The family's very rich. We know Borden products, Borden condensed milk. Everybody knows that they were cousins of that famous dairy family. And Borden himself was very wealthy as a undertaker and as a factory owner. And so this was a wonderful story to begin with. And so I had the character set that up, and then in comes Lizzie. And every time she came to a point in the inquest, and I used a lot of the inquest actual dialogue, but I edited it and I smoothed out some of the rougher patches. And every time she came to a point in the inquest, then I got free play to imagine what the scene would have been. And so there were a number of scenes that actually came about. We had to reorganize how we wanted it to progress. And what I wanted to do was go back in time and progress straight toward the murder. What could have been the causes if she had done it? What could have been the causes if someone else had done it? And let's see how these scenes lead up one by one, mounting in tension to the final moment. So that's what I designed. And it was a lot of fun. I had a scene which was, some of the scenes came out very funny. The whole scene where the whole family is poisoned. I didn't expect that one to be funny, but about 5 or 7 days before the actual murders, they all came down with summer sickness of some sort. Maybe they were eating food, old lamb stew on the stove, and that's why. But the mother, Abby, insisted that she'd been poisoned by Lizzie. And that's extraordinary. And then there was a whole story about Lizzie trying to buy prussic acid from a local druggist. And these were all things that came up, and this all was in the inquest. And so I wrote this whole scene with all the family reacting to the poisoning, and that was kind of interesting. And then there were a few other details. One crucial detail, which you can, you know, if you think I should reveal it, I will. But there was a crucial detail that was the hitch for the whole play.
Why don't you tell people what that is? Because I think that was such a compelling moment.
Well, it's what Susan Glasspell noticed when she wrote Trifles. That, you know, Trifles, the climax of the play is the two women searching the farmhouse find a bird with a broken neck. And they suddenly realize that the woman, Minnie Wright, had a reason to hang her husband because he had killed the one thing she loved, a beautiful little bird that created music. Well, 30 years, about 25 years before Susan Glasspell wrote Trifles, a classic of American literature, Lizzie Borden had kept a pigeon house. And the father, it is known, this is actually known, went in and snapped all the necks of Lizzie's pigeons about 2 weeks before the murder. And this, to me, was the thing that said, all right, the rest of her life, she gave her money to the ASPCA. The rest of her life, she was an animal lover. The rest of her life, she cared more about animals than people. And I think that's what drove her. And I come down on the side that she did do it. And that there was really just police incompetence about where the murder weapon was or whatever it was. I think it makes the most sense to me. She had the most motivation. To do something this horrific really suggested a lot of things as well. You know, there had to be a significant cause or reason. To murder a whole bunch of pigeons all at once was a big thing for Lizzie. Might not be a big thing for you, but it was a big thing for her. And the other thing was, there are suggestions, if you read her biography with a slant in a kind of particular way, that she may have well have been abused as a child in many ways. And one of the reasons why people think that might be so is pure psychoanalytical theory, but it's an interesting idea that if you have an assaulter or a sexual abuser, one of the things that you might do is attack them in the face because you don't want to see the face and of the person that you're attacking. And so when she killed Abby upstairs, her stepmother, she hacked her in the back of the head. I believe she did it, you know, 11 or 12 times, not like the nursery rhyme. And then she came downstairs and hacked her father more, about 17 times, all in the face. And why would you could kill, if you were an outsider, you're just coming in to kill somebody, you cut their throat. If you were the uncle and you wanted to kill them because, you know, you felt that they were mistreating your nieces, Why would you hack their face away? But there, it seems to build a lot of reasoning. There seems to be a lot of reasoning that supports the idea that, one, the birds were all killed, two, the poisoning incident, and three, the nature of the crimes themselves can be read in such a way that it suggests Lizzie might have done it. And so for me, those are very powerful things. And all the other characters really don't really have as much powerful motivation. So even if it isn't so, and this is a thing that I say to people who believe in their conspiracy theory, even if it isn't so, it still makes the best play, which for me became the artistic choice. What is the story that I can tell that will be the best story? So that's how it finally came together. You know, the other theories are all based on racism too, or ethnic hatred. Like there was a Portuguese guy who came in and killed them just off the street. Or you've got to remember that Lizzie was in the house when it happened. She was in the next room, thin walls, or she was right downstairs below her mother went supposedly ironing when her stepmother got killed. And she was just above her father when the horrible hacking, she heard nothing, she said. And when somebody came to the door, all they could hear was Lizzie laughing. So there are all these chilling details. They wind up in the play, most of them in the flashback sequences.
And it's fascinating. I mean, we seem to be surrounded by conspiracy theories today, but conspiracy theories are nothing new.
Yeah. And a lot of conspiracy theories are boring or strange. They don't tell good stories. For instance, the whole idea that Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare's plays, that a lord named Edward de Vere wrote the plays instead. Well, Edward de Vere doesn't have any theatrical experience. You know, they say there's a saying that he wrote a few comedies, you know, that he was very good for comedy, but we don't have any of his extant comedies and anything to measure it by. We have a few poems that he wrote, and the poems aren't anything like Shakespeare's verse. But you know, he's an attractive figure. He was highly educated. Could he have been the one who wrote it? And a lot of people find anagrams in the plays. They look for things. But they made a movie about this finally called Anonymous. And it got strange. I mean, you know, that, you know, it had to do with Queen Elizabeth and she was the mother, secret mother of Edward de Vere. And it just got so overcomplicated that you started to feel like somebody was backing up the conspiracy dump truck and pouring them all into one ridiculous story, which made no chronological sense. And I think sometimes this is what happens with conspiracy theories. They accrue, they become snowballs. And they get all of the theories connecting. This is certainly happening with the QAnon conspiracy and all of these other conspiracies. The JFK conspiracy, just read the book Crossfire. It is just an endless series of accrued conspiracy theories. And they all start to snowball together and become syncretic. It's just kind of crazy. You know, I mean, the truth, if you follow Occam's razor, has to be a little more clean than this. You know what I mean? It can't be everybody was in on it everywhere all the time. It's just a little too much.
And let me go back to Lizzie for a second too, because she's, if memory serves me correctly, she's a very dark character in your play. And I'm guessing that came from the transcripts and from the biographies and autobiographies and things that were written about her.
Yeah, she is troubled. I mean, the lines that are troubling in the play are directly from her letters. She says, "I don't know what I shall do something." I always love the diction of that. I retain the diction of her strange Victorian way of speaking in the play. I don't know but what I shall do something. That's the actual line. And I love that in the letter. And I just said, okay, she feels like she's going to do something. All of the crises in the house are coming to a head. And then there are the historical tensions with the stepmother, the things about her mother, her real mother, biological mother, dying young. And maybe she felt that her father had driven her to that. There were these fights of rich people about money and property inheritance and whether the stepmother was getting more money than the biological daughters. There were all of these little petty fights going on in the house. But I did really try very hard to make Lizzie complex. I didn't want her to be a monster. She is a little stoned when she is talking in the inquest. So she's a little abstracted. You know, the sedatives they've given her have sort of made her spacey. And so that might make her feel a little bit otherworldly and strange. When we see her in the backstory, we see her as much more dynamic and much more alive. And she even has the possibility of happiness, but that's slowly drained away from her. And then as the story continues, the thought of murdering her father becomes an abstract idea in her head. And this came from the stories of a hatchet man, who walked around the city of Fall River, and he was supposed to have been named Borden. I think his name was William Borden, if I remember correctly. And this hatchet man was walking around the town. And so I thought, well, is he real or isn't he? Is he Elvis, you know, walking around? I don't know. But he's such an interesting character, this abstract expressionistic character right out of like a Nosferatu F.W. Murnau movie, just crazy expressionistic character, that I had him come in right at the moment she started to really think about doing this. And she's getting a little bit darker and darker. And he manifests like the dagger in Macbeth in the scene. And he's singing one of the weirdest songs ever written, Listen to the Mockingbird, which is such a dark song. If you actually listen to the lyrics, it's a period song from the 1860s. And the Listen to the Mockingbird is supposed to associate with the birds that are killed later on. And also just the weird lines about death in that song are so strange. And he sings it eerily and slowly. And she starts to realize that they have a connection. And he eventually will hand her the axe, and that will become the moment. Now, did she really get the axe from her house? That's fine. But in this story, she receives the axe almost supernaturally in a dream. And that I thought was kind of very funky and far out way of doing it. But then she loves her sister, and she really wants her sister to know that she's doing it for her. So that's another motivation that she has. She loves her uncle. There's a lot that has to do with her love. I suggest that she may have been pining in some way for the maid, Maggie Sullivan, whose name wasn't really Maggie. Her name was Bridget. And I just suggest there are a lot of complicated things about Lizzie. We know that Lizzie would later on have a long relationship with an actress, and that would be her lifelong companion. And that we know that she would be a great supporter of ASPCA. And so these are things that we do know historically about her. So I did want Lizzie to have the possibility of love denied to her, but nonetheless there in the play. And so there are a lot of elements that all come in.
You also did a lot of work before the play debuted with people to make sure that they knew the historical context. I mean, you visited, you visited some classes and met with some groups of people to talk about the historical context. How much did that really factor into people saying, wow, this is an amazing story?
Yeah, I fortunately met with some of the local town experts in Fall River, and they got invited to the first pass at this play, which was in 1999. And he was thrilled. He never had seen so much of the Lizzie Borden story actually on the stage. And if anything, you know, the version that Mark and I wrote, that's probably the strength of it. It's, you know, we got the dump truck out and we poured as much of the Lizzie Borden legend, and we tried to make sense of it coherently into that story. It's there. You go a minute, you're going to get another idea. And so that's kind of the fun. It's very dense, you know, but also I think electric, you know, fun. I think it keeps moving, and it's not bogged down by those details. And I don't think any details get so obscure that the audience can't follow, but I was very pleased that some of the expert people were thrilled to see how much of the story we got into the play. We went down to Fall River and we got a sense of the street. We went into the house and they have this great tour down there at the Lizzie Borden house, where they take you from room to room. They introduce all the players like as though there were characters in a story, that you get to know the family. Then they move you into the room where Lizzie was ironing. Then they move you into the room where Andrew Borden got killed. And then they take you upstairs to the room where Abby got killed, when they show you the proximity of Lizzie's bed. And you suddenly realize that if Lizzie didn't do this crime, she was breathing the same air as the people who did. She was a hair's breadth away from them. And it's very unlikely that she wouldn't have heard something, the thud of a body, the hacking of an axe or a club. She must have heard something. And yet the reports are that, you know, they came into the house after the murders and she was laughing upstairs, which is where Abby was killed, and they could hear her laughing. And so there were a lot of very strange details that you only know once you actually go to the house, you know, that she burned something in the stove. You get to go to the kitchen and you get to see the stove. You know, was that the dress that she was wearing spattered with blood? Every little detail becomes opened up and you get to see it. It's a great tour. It actually gets into the whole history of the family and the culture of Fall River, and even includes some ghost tour elements about the neighborhood. It's a really great tour.
But we touched on this already, but I want to touch on it a little further. This play, clearly the characterizations, the themes, everything very relevant today, even though the story and the murder itself happened so long ago.
Yes. Well, first of all, the crime scene photography is a very funny metaphor for things like the O.J. Simpson trial and trials where the crime scene, we think we have all the evidence. And then we find out that because the CSI guys didn't do all of the lab work exactly correctly, or because they didn't respect the crime scene perfectly, or the police officer stepped somewhere where he shouldn't have, the whole trial's thrown out. This is a really big issue with Lizzie Borden. They thought they were being so current. They went in and they photographed this crime. It became the crime of the century, partly because there were photos of everything, photos of the hacked bodies, photos of terrifying, horrific photos of murder like nobody'd ever seen. And they hit the press and people got to see these things around the world. And they went to the best methods that French forensic specialists were inventing at the time. And they said, we're going to be up to date, because Fall River, if you remember, was a big factory community. It was a stop along the way from the garment district in New York. Everybody came to Fall River. It was unbelievably prosperous. They had the money for this. New Bedford was also very prosperous with the declining whaling industry at the time. So all of that whole area was incredibly rich. And they said, you know what? We can afford real crime scene photography. We can afford a real investigation of what this happened. We could use science. Mark Twain had written a story called those Notorious Twins, or Puddin' Ed Wilson, and he had used fingerprinting in there. So people were gung-ho to really, really find out what if science could reveal the murderer. And they did everything wrong. That's the moral lesson of the story. They did everything wrong. So one thing that's wonderful about this story is that chastening lesson about how we think science can know something perfectly. And then what science will actually tell us is what we don't know and not what we know. And maybe if the science isn't perfect and all the variables removed, you can wind up making up a story that never happened. And that is a lesson. Another thing, you know, that it's so deeply relevant because, I mean, we've had these same crimes seem to keep reemerging over and over again, like the Menendez brothers in the 1980s or so, you know, or 90s, killing their own family, parents for wealth and money. These stories keep reappearing, and we keep learning these lessons over and over again. And then that sort of strange insular nature of the aristocracy in the 19th century, which you can read about in Henry James novels, like The Gilded Age, there's a strange insular nature to the Borden family. What goes on in the Borden family stays in the Borden family. And it is a very interesting upper crust, stiff upper lip kind of attitude they have. So there's all of these things, the idea that people are beneath them, you know, and they probably had a bit of that attitude. I mean, Lizzie taught Sunday school lessons at the local church, but she did it out of noblesse oblige. You know, there's all of this in the in their personalities. And I think that's fascinating with us today, you know, American nouveau riche. I think what's relevant too is just the way we make fake news today. You know, the idea that, you know, that people might want a better story than what actually happened. The way our imaginations try to cover up and gloss over the truth. At the end of the play, Judge Blaisdell says nobody's ever going to convict Lizzie. They simply can't. It just is not structurally possible in Fall River, one, that they would accuse a woman of doing this and convict her, because they don't even want to believe a woman could commit such a crime, which is in a way nice, but also a little bit insulting to women. And it is, you know, the idea that they're incapable of violent aggression certainly is not borne out by the prisons with women's prisons in the country that we have today. And so they just don't want to believe Lizzie, a woman of high class and breeding, could possibly have committed such a crime. And it was an all-male jury that found her innocent because they did not want to believe the little lady had done such a thing. And then if you build upon that, the idea that there has to be an official story, you blame the immigrant. blame the peasant, blame a Portuguese worker from a factory, it's one of these disgruntled anarchists. Those are the people who did it. That's a story that's right there in the play. And I have Judge Blaisdell realize that this case is going to ruin his career and probably bring him to an early close in his own life, you know. And he gets a strong inkling of that before the play is over.
As a playwright, do you see yourself as someone who's trying to influence society, influence the audience that sits in front of your characters? Or are you someone who is holding a mirror up to that audience and saying, this is who we are and you need to see yourselves in this story?
I think, you know, both myself and my co-writer wanted to look at the 1890s, but from our own lens today, you know, how we would look at this story today. So that's why it's a bit of a meta play. That's why it engages in all those theories. You know, I'm chastened by your question. I'm a little bit haunted by it because, you know, Oscar Wilde tells us that an ethical sympathy is unpardonable in a poet, a writer. I don't want to have let any ethical sympathies decide the total nature of the play, but I can't deny that there are a few ethical sympathies present in the play, you know, that I do try to talk about what those people couldn't see in their time, not just what they could see. And I think that might come out a little bit different than they would have had it. They would have had it that immigrants did the crime. I think we know enough today without ethical sympathy to know that rich people can commit crimes just like immigrants. And so am I displaying an ethical sympathy for immigrants if I try to suggest that maybe that might lead to their own denial about what possibly could have happened? Perhaps. But I think that is in the play that I am. I think that do I have resentment of rich people? You know, do I have a little resentment of the way rich people behave and act sometimes? Well, you know, I've known some really great rich people in my life. I'd like to think I don't. You know, I know people who are wealthy, who really care and really give a damn. And I've known some people who were great, benefactors to the theater, who lived, you know, very wonderful lives. You know, just I've known some people. I've known millionaires. I've known a few. And they weren't bad people. They were great people. So I don't think I have a bias against wealthy people. At the same time, have I known snobs? Yes, I've known snobs too. And I think it's okay to satirize a snob. Is that an ethical sympathy? That's an interesting question. So I do have elements in the play that I think add wit, add humor to this play. I try to show how the town is in a bit of crisis about this, because they have to tell a story about Lizzie, but also a story about themselves by their verdict. And so when I tried to put all this together, there was some humor at the expense of Andrew Borden, an old-time factory owner of a sweatshop. I mean, I think most people realize, even wealthy people today, that you shouldn't run a sweatshop. And so I don't think that my play is anti-capitalist or pro-immigrant exactly, but I do have a little bit of an expose feeling of some of the excesses of people who perhaps did not respect morality in their pursuit of capitalism.
And maybe, I don't know if it's most significant, but certainly significantly, you're able to take historical figures who we have difficulty remembering are real people, because they're historical figures. They're the name, but they're not the person. And you create that characterization and bring that person to life. So now that's not just a moment in a history book, it's not just a conspiracy theory based on racism, it's actually happening in front of your eyes.
I've tried really hard to write Andrew Borden as a character, not as a stereotype of a snobby or aristocratic man. He was a factory owner at the time, and in his own point of view, from his own point of view, he talks about how his factory provides wealth for the poor people in his community. I do have those lines in the play. He quotes chapter and verse of the Bible, which he was known to do. He was supposed to have been a very hard man when it came to the excesses of modern life. He did not have running water in his home or a working toilet, even though almost every other house on that street did by the time this murder happened. So Lizzie grew up in a house that was very old-fashioned, and this man had more than enough wealth. He'd be the equivalent of a multimillionaire today. He had about $250,000 at the time. I think that comes out to about $12 million today in the bank. And so if he has this much money, why doesn't he have running water like everybody else in the street? What's going on with Andrew Borden? And I think it's this abstemiousness, this old New England abstemiousness, this, you know, I have to, you know, it's there's almost a sin in having too much excess. And so we do have him speak that way in the play. He is a hard man. He likes peace in his home. He does give his daughter a house at one point when she complains that he gave Abby a house, her stepmother. And so he isn't unresponsive to his children's needs, especially when they point out injustices or inequities. But what's interesting is that Andrew Borden is always referred to as father, which comes directly from the inquest testimony. Whereas Abby Borden, the stepmother, she only refers to her as Mrs. Borden. Mrs. Borden. This is a really crucial detail in the play. For the first 13 years or so, or 15 years of her life, she was she doesn't really remember. She was 4 years old when her mother died. And for about 15 years, she called Abby mother. She's the first mother that Lizzie remembered. She didn't really remember her birth mother. Emma, her older sister, did. But Lizzie didn't. Just vague memories. So Abby Borden was the mother in the house. And she called her mother until the incident over the house when Abby got a house and Lizzie didn't, and this property giving out thing. And it became this competition between the two of them. And then religiously, Lizzie Borden refers to the stepmother as Mrs. Borden for the rest of her life and for the rest of Abby's life. And it's interesting, even in the inquest, they say, don't you want to call your mother? And she says, Mrs. Borden. She makes a real, it's right from the inquest testimony. I know she's a little bit drugged at that point, but even so, it's a very telling detail that she has no affection for the woman who raised her. And so I ask why in the play about that.
This might be the perfect place to transition from two characters that maybe weren't the most likable characters to the play that you most recently were in
and directed
that maybe featured more than a few characters that were not necessarily likable. When you were in the audience, which is the play that I believe inspired the Netflix series The Crown.
Yes, it did.
That people are pretty enthralled with, along with directing it. You played Winston Churchill in the production recently in Norwell. Tell us about that, because I was lucky enough to see that production as well, and it was fascinating to just watch literally history parade itself across the stage.
I had a fabulous lead actress, Carol Lang Stearns, play Elizabeth. And the whole play depended on how great she was. And she was really great. And she brought the character to life with a deep inner complexity. And I really was very pleased to work with her. I'd known her a long time, probably 30 years. And I was very glad to see her because she just had an amazing energy. The play is difficult. It's difficult to stage history. It's a fun play to watch. It's a riot. It's a lot of fun. It's got beautiful moments, but it is difficult to stage history. And because people know who Winston Churchill is and they know what he sounds like, and I don't sound like Winston Churchill. And so for me to play like Winston Churchill, how are you going to create a sufficient illusion on stage? And I had to work a long time, about posture, physicality. I hope I'm a little thinner than Winston Churchill. I hope I'm a little better looking than Winston Churchill. And so one of the things that I really wanted to do is try to create those Winston Churchill expressions, the squinty eyes and the, and my neck. I had to get a crick in my neck every performance because I had to be sort of hunched over. So it was very, I'm playing Churchill at 70. I'm only 56. So it's a very interesting thing. I had a lot of fun playing it. A lot of people thought I sounded and looked exactly like him, which I took as a compliment. But it's a very interesting thing. My voice is way higher than Winston. So I don't know how that could be, but it was fun. What the play's about is Queen Elizabeth has once a week on a Tuesday evening, around tea time, an audience with her sitting prime minister. Every week, the prime minister has to come to Buckingham Palace and have a conversation about what they're doing in the cabinet and in foreign affairs and in parliament. And he has to tell her. She doesn't get to do anything about it, but he has to, because of a constitutional monarchy rule, go tell the queen every week everything that's going on. And you know, she's very frustrated, meaning that, you know, I'm called a queen, and yet I don't get to rule. I don't get to have any influence on any of this. But over the course of the play, you begin to realize that Queen Elizabeth does influence these people by being a conscience, by raising questions, by looking them in the eye when they're about to do something underhanded. By being somebody who she really took her job seriously. She read all of the communications for her entire life, and she probably still does if she can. And so she becomes this sort of interesting figure, caught between politics and the march of time and the way the world sees the monarchy. She is sort of just an individual figure that's sort of out of time, in her own place, in another dimension, sort of, and all these other people from the real world come in and out. And she has her own life too. We see her childhood. We see her love of corgis. We have corgis in the play, which everybody loved. We see her love of Scotland and her family's German ancestry. And a lot of those family elements, her as a child, when she found out that she would have to be queen when her father died. And very interesting things about how she went from being essentially a normal child to somebody who has to occupy this role for 70 years. It's very interesting to see those complications, and I actually enjoyed it. At first, I was a little bit hesitant to direct it because, you know, how would I tell my Irish ancestors that I was doing a play about the royals, right? You know, this is a interesting thing. But then I thought, well, you know, maybe I can be objective then, and I can try to have fun with it. And I think I really got a great deal of appreciation for the story, and the condition that she's in. As a person. So to play Churchill was a real treat because I really had to work on it, his line delivery, without being an impression. You can't do an impression. People, if you try to go out and, you know, we will fight them on the land, you know, if you try to do that, people will just immediately say, well, he's doing an impression of Winston Churchill. You have to talk like a person. But so that's what I did. I tried to find the lines, and I tried to make the lines move closer to the character. The other thing I'll tell you is the other prime ministers are super interesting too. And as you go through the play, you find out about the Gulf of Suez crisis and how devastating that was. That was the English Vietnam, essentially. You learn about Iraq, which was another thing they participated in with us and Tony Blair. You learn about her wonderful Labour prime minister, who really is her, they suggest her as her favorite prime minister. Harold Wilson is his name. And he really just has three scenes, and he's just absolutely wonderful character. This man who's from the working class that she really connects with. I think she liked ordinary people more than she liked snobs and people who made a big deal out of her being queen. She liked the people who worked out at the stable. She was a horse person. She liked her horse keepers, the caretakers, people who did real jobs and did real things. Those were her people. And I think that her ordinariness, as the play said, made her special.
She is definitely a sympathetic character in this play. I assume the play was written that way, and the actress and you as director really just kind of fed into that. Am I correct about that?
Peter Morgan, the guy who wrote it, kept writing the story. I mean, the play went through a lot of different versions. And when you get the version in America, it's not the version that Helen Mirren played in the West End of London. It's always changing. In fact, he updated it with things as time went along. There might even be some sly references to the Trump era in the version that we did. And when Margaret Thatcher comes in and she talks about making England great again. You know, so Morgan kept writing this play to be not just an artifact of the past, but a living document about how British government is relevant to our current concerns. And then through The Crown, the play received yet another life. And so the piece is, I think you, in order to see what Morgan's doing, you have to see the audience, you have to see The Crown, and you'll see that he's in many ways very he has a great deal of affection for the Queen. I think he had maybe even some admiration. I think he spent a lot of his life thinking about her, who she is, what she means to England, being just to her while also understanding her limitations.
And this is another case of taking iconic figures from history, whether it's the Queen, the Prime Ministers, all of those people, and creating a characterization to bring them alive. They are not just a name in a history textbook. They are human beings, which we forget sometimes, that just because you are the leader of any nation, you're also a human being. And, right. And that comes out so clearly in the dialogue between the Prime Ministers and the Queen.
Yeah, I think so, especially when Harold Wilson is suffering from Alzheimer's, which, by the way, is a little bit of a historical compression. He was actually only had incipient Alzheimer's when he left his job, and then it got worse. But he went to Oxford and he taught for many years after that. So our actor, Chris Diorio, who played Harold Wilson, actually took a class with Harold Wilson. So he actually knew Harold Wilson after he'd finished the prime minister, his work as prime minister. So, but in order to tell the story correctly of the man, they had to say this man with this tremendous memory and this tremendous gift would lose it all. And so they compressed that into the experience that you see in the play, but it's still true of him, but not quite as it was. So there's a lot of interesting things. I love that we had members of our cast who had actually known some of the people in the play. I love that some of the characters like John Major, Gordon Brown, are people that you're vaguely familiar with, or you might remember their faces. Tony Blair, of course. I think that was a great deal of fun to try to evoke those people. And some of them are interesting, quirky politicians. Some of them didn't want the job. Some of them really were too gung-ho for the job. That's all very true.
It brings me to kind of the theme of I think where we're going is how literature can tell the story of history. And it's not a new concept. Shakespeare did it. He didn't always do it accurately in his histories. He certainly took liberties. I mean, Julius Caesar is probably one of the more accurate ones that he wrote, but it's not a new concept. And yet it seems like when we want to teach students about history, it's pick up this textbook and read about it, not take this piece of literature and see the depth of these characters.
Yes. You know, Shakespeare wrote Julius Caesar from Plutarch, the great Roman historian. And it follows the arc that Plutarch writes about with the senators. And yet he was also very aware of the dissolution of England at the time of the War of the Roses and the periods after that, you know, where there was a lot of chaos in England. And he knows that what happens when you cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war, as they say in Julius Caesar. So that play was very relevant. And I think what Shakespeare did is very similar to what Morgan does. He takes a character like Richard III, who was very likely not as wicked, as evil, and as Machiavellian and as plotting as he is in the play. But he becomes a sort of symbol for the threats to Tudor England, to Queen Elizabeth, to the assassinations she's suffering at the time, to people who are plotting against you. And in a paranoid culture like Elizabethan England was, Richard III becomes the ultimate villain. He was the guy who fought with Richmond, Henry Tudor, Henry VII. And so he became the villain of the family. Was he the monster that he's supposed to have been? Did he kill children? These are all big questions. You know, the plays, as Shakespeare wrote history, Shakespeare wasn't concerned about so much about historical accuracy, but about what was relevant and what communicated important ideas to his time. Sometimes Shakespeare's plays were considered subversive. The play Richard II, where a king is killed and executed for being a bad king, was put on right around the same time as a Queen Elizabeth assassination attempt. And so they hauled Shakespeare into court and for questioning to ask him, you know, what are you in? Were you in on this? And this is one thing we know about Shakespeare, that his whole acting troupe was called in to answer to why they put on a play right at the time of an attempted coup or insurrection. So it's very interesting to think about history. If history is going to be interesting to us, it's going to be because it addresses things that we're talking about and doing today. And we reshape history based on the people we are today. People say that history is written by the winners, but it's not really. History is constantly rewritten by whoever's reading history. And so it's written by the winners perhaps immediately afterwards, but then after a while, if records survive and sometimes they can be reconstructed, history gets another look and another look and another look. And finally, history becomes all the views of all the people, winners and losers, and together. And that's who writes history, finally.
I think you would agree that the time period that we're in today, knowing our history, knowing world history, is quite possibly more crucial now than it has been in any other time period.
Yeah. You know, knowing world history at a time when a society might be in denial about fundamental things like climate change and political coups, knowing world history, say the history of 1917 and what happened to the Tsar at a time when Russia is attacking Ukraine, knowing the history of the 4 million who died in Ukraine under Stalin, and the 20 million Russians who died under Stalin, and how reluctant Russians are to go back to the world of Stalin. That's a piece of history people might need to know. These are all things that people are living with and very afraid of today. When we think about the politics of our modern country, the divisive nature, some people like to point out that, you know, the American Civil War was more divisive because they killed each other over minor quarrels, but they were also damn gentlemanly about it. There was no vitriol at all. They said, well, I must kill my own brother now. Sorry, brother. You know, brother against brother. They did it in such a gentlemanly way. History is such a strange thing. You know, it's very hard to apply any time period to our present day. Go back 200 years to when the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States was shot by someone. And he was killed. And they chased after the man who shot the Secretary of the Treasury. And they brought him back to Washington, D.C., where he was forced to complete his term as vice president as his punishment. Aaron Burr shot Alexander Hamilton. His punishment was to complete his term as vice president. That was a strange punishment. You know, he didn't go to jail for 50 years for assassinating a government figure. He wasn't executed. Dueling was a thing gentlemen did back then, so they gave him a pass on that. But they said, you better finish your term. It's a very odd thing. You know, when Tupac and Biggie are dueling in the 1990s, they're seen as nothing but criminals. And so Lin-Manuel Miranda makes a play in which he says, you know, these guys, Hamilton and Burr, were a lot closer to our pop music figures of the 90s than you might think. And I think he makes a darn good case for it. But it's hard because they certainly don't behave the way our politicians behave today. And much of our world today is concerned with authoritarian control and punishment. And when you live in a country where everybody's afraid all the time, you think you can kill things to make the bad go away, make the trouble go away. But it's interesting to think about the culture we have today where we're constantly trying to kill things to make things go away, or constantly trying to use punishment or, you know, and now I'm displaying a real ethical sympathy, but that's because you're asking me about history and not about my art or what I'm writing. When I try to write this stuff, I really don't try to think like somebody exactly thinks like me today. I mean, I want to pick out the things that people will be interested in Lizzie Borden or in the audience and make those things very relevant today. But I don't want to just make things a soapbox from my point of view. I always tell my students, you know, please don't think like, it's a really important thing for me. And then I tell them not to believe anything I say, but do me the honor of looking it up. It's easy. Go online and look it up. If I'm going to say something about the modern world, or if I'm going to say something about history or evolution or any of these controversial topics that people find, whether the earth is round instead of flat, my students will say, will you tell us the answer? I said, will you look up the answer, is my answer usually. Would you find out what the thinking is? Because if I tell you, you're just going to forget it and you're going to be re-asking this question in a year. All right, or 6 months. And so it's very important for me that people not believe what I say. If I should let something out and slip, I would much rather them go and find out for themselves. And so I can say, you can take what I say as a guide and then come back and tell me how wrong I was. That's fine with me. But don't believe me. Don't believe me. That, to me, that is tragic. I always tell my students that when you are in elementary school, you're supposed to believe your teacher because she tells you how to draw an S and you have to draw an S exactly the way she does. And so there's a lot of fundamental learning that goes on that has to be transmitted from teacher to student. But when you get to college, you're supposed to not believe your teachers. You're supposed to be arguing critically. You're supposed to be saying, isn't this a possibility? Isn't that a possibility? And so I really do like that. So that being said, disclaimer being said, boy, do I think there are a lot of things we can learn from a really solid understanding of history today.
And it seems like it's our job to turn to the playwrights, to those who write literature, to get that context, not just for the history, but even for the context of the world in which we currently live.
Yeah, it won't be alive unless we dramatize it sometimes. And I always love that C-SPAN show where they have, is it history or not? You know, is it real or is it history? And they have like five historians watching a movie like Gandhi, and they'll say, well, it's not exactly what happened. He actually was here when this happened. They'll argue about all the details. And I actually do enjoy that. I think that if you watch something and it gets you to feel something about Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, if you watch something and it gets you to feel something about John Adams in 1776, or David McCullough's HBO version with Paul Giamatti, you know, I mean, if you see some dramatic presentation of John Adams and you suddenly say, I want to know about this guy and who he was. I'm trying to think of some of the best history films of the past 20 or 30 years, the ones that made you feel like history had come alive. Lincoln was written by Tony Kushner, and who wrote Angels in America. And here's a person with an exceedingly modern sensibility, probably one of the great modernist playwrights, looking back at Abraham Lincoln to try to see who he was, and actually being very canny about the man and his limitations. And I think you can go back and you can look through Lincoln, and you can know that Kushner connected to Dorothy Kearns Goodwin, and that they tried to bring together Lincoln's life on film, and in a way that was still dramatic, and that did take liberties with the truth and did move things around. But sometimes you need to do that to tell the story in such a way that it's going to be powerful for people. And then they're going to go read a book by Ron Chernow about Alexander Hamilton.
And as one of the storytellers of our time, are you working on something now? Is there a project looming in the not so distant future?
Yeah, I mean, as for my own pieces, I'm working on a play called Goblin, which is an interesting nightmare story. And I'm trying to put horror on stage. It's not historically based, but since I've already dabbled a little bit with horror with Lizzie Borden, I want to deal with the goblin mythos. And this is a very interesting and disturbing, edgy play. And that's one thing I'm working on. And then other things. One perspective that I really have today is that a lot of information is transmitted orally and through video format, but nothing beats reading. And I want people to relearn how to read. It's my biggest thing I'm talking about all the time today. Close reading, reading that opens up the universe. And someday I'd love to do another one of these podcasts in which we read a very short story like Story of an Hour by Kate Chopin. And I would love to just demonstrate how many possibilities are in two pages of a classically written text, because it's shocking how much. I've been teaching Cask of Amontillado for a long time, a story that students are usually sick of by middle school. Like, oh my God, I've had to read it three times. Why is this teacher assigning it again? And I tell them, just go with me for a second. Just go with me. And by the end of an hour of them forensically looking over the text, they usually find out that they've never read the story at all and that they just thought they did. So I feel like there's a real big thing with close reading that has to happen. I think it was a movie called Eating Raoul. It might have been that movie where somebody said to somebody, when they said, I'm taking a speed reading class. And another character said, no, you don't need a speed reading class. What you need is a slow reading class. You need to slow down and read what you are reading on the page. You got to read it for real. And you got to ask questions with every sentence and every moment. You got to listen to the music of the words as it appears on the page. And if you don't do that, you're not really reading. And the last thing I'll say, which is something I say to all my students, is that when I read a book that I bought, I read every word of it because I bought it. I'm not going to shortchange myself. I don't skip stuff. I read it slowly to enjoy it. I don't try to rush through it because I paid for it. I want to enjoy every single moment of it. And I want to get everything. And the other thing I'll just add, one more postscript, is that I read somewhere, someplace, that somebody said that students learn more from the chapter summary at the end of a chapter than they do from the actual 20-page or 30-page chapter that they just got assigned in a textbook. And I agreed entirely that that's true. When I read that, I said, of course that's true. Because they read that chapter summary like it's the Dead Sea Scrolls. They read it and they try to extract all of the content from 50 or 100 words. They try to get every bold-faced word and understand it as though they were piecing together the manuscripts lost from Alexandria. All right? And they just flip through the pages of the chapter. So when you read that intensively, your mind is going to explode. It's going to be a great journey.
And it sounds like that's the perfect message to leave people with for this episode. So I will say thank you as always for enlightening us, for opening our minds, and for giving us a lot to think about, because it is always fascinating to have these conversations with you.
Thank you, Greg. This has been a blast. And let's do another one sometime. Let's do that close reading thing that I talked about.
We would like to thank Professor Steve Dooner for joining us this month for the JFY Network's podcast. We hope you will tune in again next month when our focus on history continues and we speak with Hubie Jones, the Dean of Boston Social Reformers, as he shares his experiences of driving the campaign for racial justice in the city of Boston.
Now, Mel was in the picture also with me, because in April of 1963, I came up with the idea of having a one-day general strike called Stop, where we would ask all black people and our white allies to stay out of work for a day to protest all forms of racial discrimination in Boston, and not to ride the public transportation and not to shop. And I went to Mel King with the idea, and he thought it was a great idea.
Look for our podcast featuring a conversation with Hubie Jones beginning May 26th. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.